planned, but fully aware of all of the changes that are occurring in the 1930s and of the history of violence and in the mining industry, and it responds to the basic demands of a workforce that wants better wages, hours, safety, health conditions, and so you know you have to do something. What plan it well and do it well, because first of all you're remotely located, and the transportation obstacle for injured people is one thing. So you have to provide something more than a typical miner's first aid safety course and then a long distance run. This model mining community is it takes in what I told you earlier. It cuts across to one era, the company town approach to things. On the other hand, it recognizes the advent of a new social and industrial order that is, if not going to be in Holden, exists beyond Holden. And next thing you've got to understand is that Howe Sound is an international mining corporation. This would be then a division. This is the result of picking up on a very promising prospect in the scheme of the international North American continent. The time is right to, in terms of technology. First of all, you can use now. You can lower the cost for the transportation obstacle. After World War I, it was clearly evident that the truck was the wave of the future. So hard rubber tire trucks, or trucks, would replace railroads as a form of extracting this resource. So you're in that kind of a situation with technology. You've got new kinds of percussion drills. You've got methods for extracting, for breaking large quantities of ore through a system of engineering that was devised after years and years of mining engineering training and application of that engineering education in the coal mining of the East Coast. It's long hole drilling, where you drill long holes and then you would drill and drill and drill, and then you would engage in a cracking, large dynamite explosions and break the rock in seams, and then you would have lots of material to haul out. Well, you've got that, and you're on the edge of at the end of one time. Now you're Howe Sound of Civic Four is an international mining corporation. In the 1930s, prior to the Depression, it has a mine in Britannia Beach. It's a principal mine. It has a mine in Mexico, San Luis Potosi, and in 1928, one of its newly acquired field engineers, C.V. Brennan, who had worked at Granby. Granby was the Consolidated Smelting and Refining Company, operated with British and American capital through a general manager, vice president out of Spokane. And the Granby Mining Company and its smelters at Granby British Columbian Trail was the largest smelter operation until after World War I in the British Empire. So you have a lot of mining engineers that are trained in America or in Canada that move back and forth across the border, and you have a lot of Canadian engineering work, developmental knowledge about the property that's been handed down since Granby first began leasing here in 1906 and doing some extensive prospecting and development until it finally did not exercise an option, its fourth option or fifth option, in 1917, because it didn't really know how long the war would go. Americans had planned once they entered it to go 4 or 5 years, but Europeans ended it the year after the Americans got in. Well, anyway, they didn't exercise, but there was a tremendous amount of prospecting, drilling knowledge that had been developed up to 1928. So that by the time that Howe Sound gets involved, and Brennan recommends three mining properties. Because these properties are Hidden Creek and Flin Flon properties in British Columbia, and this property in the state of Washington. And this property had become known to the Granby Company as really one of the top three prospects in North America and Northwest America. So Brennan was like any other mining engineer. One of the great ideas of mining engineers had always been, of course, that they would get an education, go out as a field exploration engineer in their lace boots, and discover a property and be able to recommend it to a company. The company would then, you know, say, okay, let's build a mine, and that person would then be appointed mine superintendent, and then that person would go on to richness and fame and glory forever and ever, a world without end. But by the 1920s, there were so many engineering schools at work, mining engineering schools, that mining engineers became like teachers in the 60s. They became a glut. They glutted the market, and so they could be bought and sold willy-nilly. So there's a lot of talented engineers. And so what Brennan had been doing in the Granby Company is he got an opportunity to become a field exploration engineer for Howe Sound. And as when he was hired, he said, "All right, this property is hot. Let's exercise a lease option on it." In 27, he was working for Granby, and he got the job in 28 with Howe Sound. Howe Sound, as soon as they heard the lease option was up, they said, "Yeah, let's go talk to this fellow Crooker Perry, who had taken over the Holden mine and reorganized it as the Lake Chelan Copper Company." He said, "Sure, let's take a 4-year lease option on it for $240,000, and then in 32 we'll decide whether or not we're going to do something with it." Well, you all know that by 1932 the economic system in the West was in the pits. And things got pretty bad in terms of a competition of totalitarianism and German's economic system for uprighting itself with the West. And so you know all that story. Anyway, when Howe Sound, you know, was no different than any other company, they inherited the engineering knowledge. They then came to develop a greater knowledge of the mine. They continued to diamond drill all over it. They used a crew of about 100 people way up on the slopes. They began to search for ways of maybe generating their own power supply rather than having to use Washington water power, to try to start to begin the plan to figure out if they were to exercise the option, where would they put the town site, and they had mill site leases, where would they get tailings, where would they put it here down on Lake Chelan. And they went through all this with the state of Washington, and they met with local interest groups, and of course local chambers of commerce and local merchants waited with bated breath to find out whether or not, you know, they would, and if they would, you know, could they put stores in this town, and would there be roads built here directly, you know, and on and on. Well, this is an international mining corporation, and it was thinking big in the 1920s, and this was truly the best known low-grade copper deposit. It had been promoted. It was well known, in throughout the United States and Canada as probably Washington's best. There were bits and pieces around of mining properties, but none by 1932, none with the ore zones that had been revealed in this property. Granby had started out developing on Holden's information in his four tunnels that there was not only one huge ore zone real high, encased, you might say the vein was encased in solid rock, but they were probing around, they had found the top of a second one. And before they had finished doing surface drilling and underground exploration, Granby, prior to Howe Sound's leasing it from Perry, after Granby did not decide to exercise lease in 28, Granby's engineers had told this fellow Brennan, "Now look, not only is there one, really our best estimates say a million ton of rock that could be worked up high, but we probed and we found, you know, the dimensions to two, and there's the possibility that independent of that, there is even yet the top of a third zone of ore." And, you know, and Perry, I mean, that was what excited Brennan and Howe Sound, and they jumped on it, and they went to work to try to prove up whether or not there was a third zone of ore. Now, the estimates were running that it was, if with the discovery of the second zone of ore, that they probably had about perhaps 2 million ton of 3% or less low-grade ore. If that was so, how much more? So the Hao San Company discovered and proved up and confirmed the theory of N.E. Nelson, of Granby, and through Brennan's coordination, that there was three zones of ore and perhaps more, all above the present 1500 level that I showed you today, all above that. Okay, and who knows, and you know, which directions this ore vein went. You know, it could go out towards the Buckskin Formation. It might go, you know, be interrupted by the valley here, might continue on through Bonanza. Maybe it was somehow distantly related to the Chihuahua over the Phelps Creek out of Lyman Lake, up over the Lyman Glacier and down into the Phelps Creek drainage. Maybe it was related to that fragmented ore zone called the Trinity or mines on the Chihuahua River, because it had outcropped there. Maybe, you know, it was such that you'd find the vein heading that direction and you'd end up tunneling from here towards the Red Mountain Mine, as it was called. Well, you know, there were all kinds of good feelings by 1932 about, this. And the problem was then when to start. In 32, the things were very tight and the company had to lay off and shut down. Otherwise, it probably would have moved sequentially to, because it had purchased itself 500,000 shares of the 2.5 million shares of stock of the Lake Chelan Copper Company. It moved in 32 once it saw where it was going and where the world was going. It moved to, under penalty, to exercise its option and buy the mine for $240,000 plus a $2,500 penalty clause. Hao San had 500,000 share, and the Crooker Perry, the banker who had taken it over because he had loaned money to J.H. Holden and had reorganized the company in order to protect his investment, he eventually gotten $21,000 plus in the hole on this. Anyway, they bought it, and so Perry had over 1,300,000 shares, and that gave him a nice tidy sum in four equal installments he more than recovered his investment in the Holden mine, and the Lake Chelan Copper Company was changed to the Chelan Copper Company, and Hao San called this area then Chelcop briefly before finally establishing a post office here and then changing the name to Holden, a name in honor of James Henry Holden, who was the discoverer of this property in 1896. Oh, gosh. So they exercised the option. And then, you know, things just went dead. The copper prices per pound went to 14 cents and hovered between 14 and 13 cents, and that was the price of copper per pound before in the depression of 1913. And even then, in 1914, and when the war increased in intensity, World War I, the price shot up, you know, to around 20, 21 cents, but that was a wartime demand, wartime pressures. So the company had always, on with railroads and doing an operation where the smelter and the milling process would be down late at Chelan Falls and all that, they'd estimated that just at that time, to break even, they'd need about 14.5 cents a pound on the market just to break even, you know. Perhaps a transportation company could haul out other people's claims that could make money off their transportation and smelting operation to offset that. Well, anyway, it was pretty dismal, the copper prices, and there was no stability and no security for low-grade copper deposits. And then there was a meeting in New York, an international meeting of companies like Hao San, and finally, the free world decided they would develop an international mining metals market and stabilize it, and you know, and for national defense purposes and other reasons, because of the spread of Hitler's Germany and its economic spread, control of parts of the world. And anyway, so then by 36, the Hao San said, okay, we do annual assessment work. Mining claims are required to do annual assessment work. Each claim is required to do so many hundreds of dollars work a year. So they came up and did their annual assessment work, kind of cleaned the property up. And in 36, they moved a crew of people on the property, kind of with just a little bit more involved in their minds than just doing assessment work. 36, the metal markets begin to improve. They've done some more surveying. They put a larger workforce on. They're beginning to clear away the old brush on the old trail, which is a little wider now. And 36 gives way. They do some all through that winter, 36. And then they put a skeletal crew on at the mine to continue to work on building a haulage tunnel. And they kind of keep working up there. And then on January 1st, as I told the people on the hike, the company announced to the world, to the Northwest, that it is going to begin production here. They're going to put this mine into operation, and they're going to try to put it into operation in a year. They're going to build the entire set of systems needed. Docks, barges, tugs are going to subcontract this to the electrical process, the building of the right, the electrical, the power lines, and they're going to build this town and dorms and houses and everything and put in the transportation, sewage, water, the whole, and put in the mill, and all in a year, and they do. By the winter of December of 37, electricity is connected and flowing, and now they're just a matter of months away from sending out their concentrate. They've now got a wide road, the road you see now. They're building a switchback from the top of the hill. They're, in the meantime, they're using a tramway system up from the dock that you see up that ravine. When you get to the top of the hill, just before you get to the top of the switchbacks, there's a little road that goes off the side. That was a Packers camp station called Dan's Camp, and the road goes around the side to the gully. They had a tramway in there, and they hauled lots of stuff in here. And they've logged off and cleared off and burned off and cut off and timbered all this special dimension timber you see. And they've also purchased an awful lot of local supplies, a lot of lumber and cement, things like that, and oil and diesel and gallons and the big barrels and all that. And they're really working. They used to create the ballpark as a staging area. They put in an auxiliary power plant and a steam generating plant, a small one, mainly a diesel electric plant. They bring up drills, compressor systems that they can haul on tractors. They take that and cut a road up into Honeymoon Heights. They, in the late 30s, they've winterized the place. By 32, it's all winterized, so they can handle people year-round, and the crews can work three crews at a time. And they just widen the road a little bit more and haul those compressors up and down and just keep exposing, getting all the information they can on the area. Late March, a load of balls, steel balls, is loaded on it to Chelan on a barge. These are like shot put. And that signals that when they take those up lake, that they're going to put those in the big ball mills, and those will be used to pulverize the rock. And so they take them up lake, and they've got the dikes that they put in the riprap, the log riprap on the other side of the river here, and they've started to put dirt, haul dirt in, and to build the dikes, and the mill's up, and everything's ready to roll, and they put the ball mill in, and all of a sudden they invite up a whole lot, big delegation of people to come up here, and they take them on a tour, take this boatload of people, of dignitaries, on a tour, and they notify RKO, Radio Pathé News, or whatever it is, that they're Movie Tone News, that, this is a big deal. I had to come down to Lake Chelan and see this whole big deal. Chamber of Commerce coordinated the mine, and they had a big tour and the Mucky Mucks and the big dance, and all the people in town. Chamber of Commerce says, okay, now we're going to commemorate this occasion of the first removal of concentrate from here since its discovery 42 years later. So the Chamber of Commerce arranges for a great flotilla of boats to go up Lake Chelan, and when the tug and the barge start coming down, they will escort it into the barge docking operation at Chelan, and then they'll put bunting on trucks. They'll close down the town for half the day. They'll get the high school band out, and on April 8th, they all meet over at Chelan Dock, and lift the big buckets out and put them on the truck, and the marching band plays, and everybody, the Grand Poobah, gives his speeches, and everybody talks on and on, and says what a wonderful thing this is, you know, and it's really kind of, you know, it's kind of neat. Hundreds of people have been at work putting it in, but the work isn't done. You know, while everybody in Chelan is busy, you know, celebrating the removal of this concentrate and all that stuff, and the movie Pathé News is recording it. I don't know if the film has been dissolved. I still want to find that. Maybe I will someday find the 1938 news clip of it. They go to, you know, the people up here are still working. They still have to build more houses. There are people, miners, living in little one-room houses with tent coverings. They've made an appeal for a land area that you know as Miners Village. And so Winston Construction Company of Minneapolis goes up and adds the Winston addition on to this town. It's really called Winston Camp rather than the Miners Village, but so be it. You know, it's Miners Village to you. And so geography and the slide area and everything dictates it be placed there rather than adjoin the town site here. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting experience then. They've been able to coordinate tremendous amounts of effort. I guess totally about 4.5 million, as best as I can estimate, approximately from the time of discovery until the building of the town and the constructing of it, about $4.5 million go into the process of developing this and building this town site, promoting, you know, from the prospecting days forward, $4.5 million of, you know, money. And with the company putting in probably about $3 million to get it under ready for production, $3 million, which isn't not a lot really, but it is a lot in those days. And so, you know, the government's on the side of these small mining companies, these low-grade properties. And off it runs for 19 years. And runs rather much better, I think, than they expected. One, there were lots of small injuries, quite a few accidents in the construction of the mine, a few deaths, not many. A fellow drowned in the lake stringing cable. A boat overturned with the cable rolling when they were spanning the lake for the power line. A fellow lost his fingers putting in a boat ramp. Some people lost their fingers and got serious injuries in the construction of the mine. One fellow died at between 28 and 32 of what they thought was encephalitis. They sent a nurse up in the middle of the winter in a boat. Doctor wouldn't go up to quarantine the camp. Fellow died, but it didn't spread. It wasn't potentially an epidemic. Didn't kill anybody else. The young fellow was from Canada. They sent his body back home, and they named the ridge up here in his memory, Martin's Ridge. You know, what do you? I'll answer questions. You know,
what did they do with the ore concentrate after they got it to Chelan?
Well, the Granby smelter closed in 1921, and so the only smelter left was over in Tacoma. So they had to ship that concentrate in ore cars to Tacoma to the smelter at Ruston, right around by Point Defiant, around the other side of Commencement Bay, and there they smelted it.
Did they haul it into Wenatchee where they put it on cars?
No, they hauled it to Chelan Falls, and then from there they hooked them on trains and moved them from Wenatchee and on over the Great Northern Line.
Speak of low grade, what? You said low grade ore that they took out. Is there a higher grade or?
Oh yeah. Well, this was anyone. This is 3%.
That's the amount that you get out of a ton of
rock.
Rock, I see. Then a higher grade ore, you get a lot more.
Yeah, 10%.
This is all low grade.
Yeah, and by the time the mine closed, it was around 1%.
And most of that concentrate was like a bunch of sand and gravel, and then it was taken to the smelter, and the copper was taken.
It was a fine powder consistency, like the tailings, except it looked kind of greenish for copper, and kind of grayish for zinc, I guess would be the way to put it. And it was kept kind of damp.
And that's where they took it all out at the mill.
Oh yeah, right up here, yeah. And they just put it on 3 trucks. You'll see the trucks.
But how did they take the gold out of there?
It just settled down.
From the bottom?
Yeah, the flotation cells. Yeah. Yeah. And they just come in and sluice it out, and then, you know, and then haul it out for refining. Critical point in all that, like I told you today, was in the assay office. And the computations made in the assay office, that was the those percentages that they assayed were the percentages that the smelter based its computation of how much money the company would earn. And so it's very critical that those computations be really accurate and really good, because that was the point where, you know, bulk income was determined.
How many people are up here at the ice pond?
Well, the most they say is 601 in the 1950 census. So, you know, some people say at peak employment, 350 people would be employed here. Four underground shifts, three shifts working, you know, mining, and another shift that would overlap two of those shifts to clear it up. Question?
Did you say you were born here?
Yeah, my parents, my father came up here to work, and then we built a home, and before the home was built, my mother would come and visit him, and I was conceived up here on a weekend when they were up here, and apparently she was working in the bank, and then apparently about 2 months after I was born in 39, I was brought up here.
Where did you live? Is the house still standing?
No, the house isn't standing. It's in the miners' village.
That must make you sad.
No. Oh, that's the first, the hard part was, well, you know, when you're growing up and you get out of high school and the mine closes, you have to go do something else. You always assume, well, your home's there. When I came back here, when we were inventorying the records here, I came back one Christmas when the winter crew was on it. I walked up there with the December snows on, and it was a small early snow, late snow that year. And you walk around trying to find your house because you hadn't really hit you. And then you realize, no, it's been returned to a state of nature. And that kind of bothers you, but there's nothing to do about it.
Did you spend a lot of time in snowmobiles in the wintertime up here?
They didn't have snowmobiles. They had Jeeps, and some people kept their cars up here. There were trucks and delivery vans and snow graders and cats. And if we went out, we tracked, we snowshoed, we cross-country skied, we downhill skied with rope toes, and we did those kinds of things. We dug tunnels and went out hunting Christmas trees. And
the reason I asked that, I was up in Valdez a couple of years ago in Alaska, and they have about 12 foot of snow usually. It fills up one of the buildings, and there's one kid there working the service station, and I says, you stay here year round? Oh yeah. And he says, well, gee, what do you do here in the wintertime? I bet it gets awful boring for a young fellow like you. No, he says, that's when we have our fun. And he says, we have got snowmobiles, and we take off to the lakes that we couldn't normally get to unless we had to hike, and the snowmobiles got up in there, and the ice fished, and what have you.
Well, it would have been interesting. Since they kept the tavern at Lucerne, it would have been interesting to see how many, if they had had snowmobiles, how many fellows would have taken the snowmobiles down to Lucerne for a beer and hauled a case back in. But usually you could have it hauled in.
Well, that's the question. How about all the hops up here? Was that those brought in here for the miners to make their own brew? I was wondering about all the hops. Never seemed to, like, all the houses got it grown.
Were the mines union
mines?
Were they organized?
Yes, they were. They were helped along by that by the company, because the company had to sell they had to take their to the Tacoma smelter their ore and concentrate, and that was a union smelter. Wouldn't have been handled otherwise. So in December of 1937, they dropped the wages by $1 a day, which caused the mine mill and smelter workers at the CIO to come right in here and organize. And, you know, interesting. It would have been in any way. Mr. Bly, who was one of the consultants, John Bly of Spokane, former mining engineer, mine foreman, came up on the boat to work here after graduating from Pullman as a mining engineer, and worked as a miner for a while. He came up with the first organizer. I'll tell you a little tradition that it was a nice tradition in the evening. You see, one of the things people are involved with here is conquering nature. You can love to conquer nature. It's awfully hard work. You don't succeed, probably, the romantics tell you, but you conquer nature, and come on, you're tired. And very few of them, you know, cared about climbing mountain peaks and yodeling. They were very tired. They liked to play pool in some little Hank Snow. And, you know, they liked their drink. But they drank together and got to know each other because they had to work together as a team. And they were working in what could be potentially very dangerous situations. They might have to run and drill into an old dynamite set up and blow themselves to smithereens. Or they might eat lunch out in the tunnels and a rock might fall on them and squish them. A couple of deaths were caused by those things. One of the things that they did, though, is besides feed the chipmunks like you people do, is they would take evening strolls, and there was a tradition that didn't get much publicity, didn't have to, was that when you walk down the road to Lucerne, about every mile when the water's running, there's a stream. And so the idea was that down the road was, at every stream, was ice cold beer. So when you went on an evening hike, you put a couple of beers in your coat with a little pouch in the back and walk down the road, and when you stop to have a beer or a stream, you put a warm bottle in to replace the cold bottle you'd taken. So, or you'd come back up at night, up the road, you might want to stop, have a picnic or that, you'd go over and take your six-pack of warm beer and put it in there and take a six-pack of cold beer out of the stream.
Honor system, huh?
Oh, yeah. And then I worked on the road crew, and that was kind of great. Because first I told somebody that works, one of the people that in the mechanic here, I told him that when one of the initiating ceremonies I didn't know was they decided that the miners would come back to go to work on the second shift, what they call swing shift. Well, what they'd do is they'd start plying me with warm beer because I was picking rocks on the road and helping people in. And by the late afternoon, quitting time, I was really plastered. And I was only about 15. I got a special work permit. And they had to make out my time card and take me home. But sometimes we would be down the road working, picking rocks and that. And we would go off, chase deer, or we'd have 1 hour siestas, or, you know, just lots of fun things, or maybe even have one of those cold beers left.
What did your mother say?
Oh, she's a little upset. Upset. But then, of course, we had a club of boys, a bunch of us had a gang. One of the rules of the gang was to be a member of the gang, you had to sneak into the basement of your dad's own house or your neighbor's, whoever it was, designated house, and steal a quart of homebrew and bring it to the gang so we could drink it. But, you know, it's kind of nice.
They did use the hops for that, huh?
Well, they made a lot of homebrew. Every 3 days, you know, every so often, they put the homebrew together and people get together and talk. That's how the men. When the visiting minister from Wenatchee would come up and have services, then they would all congregate. The men would congregate in our basement. And there the minister would sit and drink homebrew with the men, and they'd talk and have their religious services of sorts. And they'd go on all night, and they'd minister back on the bus. Couldn't wait. There was always a waiting list of ministers who wanted to come up here. Yes.
What kind of entertainment did you have?
We had movies 3 days a week, and the movies cost 10 cents a piece. And there was a new movie every, you know, on the bus. And the
current movies?
Huh?
Current movies.
Current movies. And, you know, the usual fare that came, you know, with the shorts, the comedies, the news, the whole bit. And, so people could go to the movies. They could go down like you do and bowl. They were in leagues. Sit in the library, you know. And then they had visiting. This rec hall was funded in part by a community club of dues, and the community club then the facility helped to pay the expenses of keeping up the bowling alley and the business. The men had basketball leagues and they had visiting AAU teams. There were lots of school exchanges where kids just from other schools out that lived outside would want to come up here and spend a weekend with the kids, and all kinds of exchanges like that. And then there were the picnics like the kids are going to have tomorrow, so the whole town would participate. There were foot races and pie eating contests, nail driving for all ages, and then followed by lots of pop and beer and ice cream, and you know, and then followed by a big dance. And at 1 o'clock the band stopped, everybody started throwing money on the stage. And then they also had a lot of, you know, they had open house and you could go to different houses and for dinner or breakfast after the dances. And they had kept this building along here where the grass is. You'll see a picture tonight shows a sheet of snow before you enter go down into the rec hall. They called that Bottle Row. In other words, when you came to the dance, you put your bottle and mix in the snow. And if you went in to dance to live music, and if you wanted a drink, you just simply went out and mixed yourself a drink, and nobody made a big to-do out of it, you know. But the miners were, you know, the miners were very careful about their drinking. They didn't like to see a public display, you know, of drunkenness, nor did they like to see a lot of foul-mouthed language. I mean, they just really didn't like to see that. They, I don't, you know, it's explainable, but they really were very careful to watch their language and to watch themselves and their consumption of alcohol, or if they ran short, you know, whenever they ran through a loaf of bread, strained through a loaf of bread. And they were really, I watched one man who was having an argument with his wife, and he slapped her, and I watched three men beat that man unmercifully for you know, touching his wife. It was kind of, and those kind of things. There's lots of activity. Mountain climbing, fishing, deer hunting, fishing, I don't know, you name it.
Were there live stage shows? I've heard that, was Elizabeth Taylor was up here or something? Like
oh, that? Yeah, in the 40s they made a movie. And they, you know, did a few things with the lassie come home, but it's kind of, you know, there's a lot of things going on with that. But they had visiting dance companies and local groups brought up their, like the Sir Optimus Club, and they'd bring up some of their blackface acts or whatever it was. So there's a lot of things going on, and kids always, you know, people were always coming and going from the town.
Did you go to the high school in Chelan then?
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of interesting.
Did you every day?
No. It was a boarding with a lady and her son in her home near the golf course, or the park, I should say. Yeah. I was going to say something like, oh, yeah, the company, this is, you know, the company is worried about keeping its taxes down, too. So the Lake Chelan School District saw an opportunity to add this to its tax base in the 30s. And the company got the parents in there, appealed for a school. Appeal only for a great school. But they would do everything they could to you know, make it a good grade school and provide it with everything. And they did, you know, as long as they had only 8 grades to deal with. Every room had its own library, you know, and they made sure that the gymnasium was specifically arranged and set up for all kinds of multi-purpose activities. You know, and any visitor of any importance was always encouraged to come and speak and show their wares before the students, things like that.
Were the teachers paid by the Alsam Main Company?
Yeah, they were the Lake Chelan School District, and they were paid by the school district, and the principal and 3 teachers, and the women together at kindergarten in their own homes for a while. But the first and second grade were in one room, third and fourth, and fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grades were in the other room.
Well, what was the original use of, I guess, the building? I assume that the...
This?
I assume, no, not this building, but I like the 3 lodges and the chalets, I assume the management personnel lived in the chalets.
Yes.
And what about the 3 lodges? How
were they used? These were miners' dorms.
The single miners?
Yes, 2 miners, 2 rooms. In a very, very nice situation. I mean, you had a bull cook who gave you, made, who changed your bed and made it, swept your room, cleansed your sinks, kept you, you know, and the shower and toilet facilities were at the end of the hall like they are now, and, you know, the windows were always kept up, you know, kept clean, everything was always kept nice and neat. You know, your beds were always made. You couldn't ask for a better deal for a couple dollars, you know, $2.50 a day. You know, and then all the food you could eat. You know, and then all the, you could make the biggest lunch in the world, or you could go in there late at night to the sandwich area and make it. If you came off a late shift, you went down to the cafeteria where the ice cream parlor is, and there you automatically got a steak dinner. You know, there
you said a couple dollars a day, but in 1939, wages was wasn't too much.
Well, the wages went up pretty fast. By the 50s, the minimum day labor wage was $13.13 a day. With most of the wages around $17 to $18 a day. But like I said on the hike today, the really difficult thing with the wage structure was that the miners outnumbered the mill workers and the surface crew. And so they only cared about gypo production. They could make a heck of a lot more money off of production work than they could off of an hourly wage. And so they simply didn't give diddly about wage structures to speak of. They were hard to get mobilized. They thought, they came to think of themselves as the, you know, the mucky mucks of work, you know. And they really did work. I mean, you could make, you know, you could double your money on production work. And so, you know, so they weren't sympathetic.
What were their work schedules like?
Well, in the beginning, they worked, they agreed, they worked two weeks at a time, no time off, 7 days a week, 8 hours a day, plus plenty of overtime. Then the shift bosses worked a lot of 7 day weeks, and then during the war they agreed not to strike, and picked up a fringe benefit when Lewis took the coal miners out for the 8 hour a day portal pay. And so they basically worked an 8 hour day with you know, time and a half for overtime on Saturday, 5 days a week, and Saturdays and double time on Sundays. And they scrambled, they liked that.
When they had time off after a 2 week shift, how long was their time?
A couple of days. That's all they needed, some of them. Yes?
I'm curious, did Victor Brennan ever manage this camp?
Came up for a while, but basically he worked out of, Brennan worked out of Britannia Beach.
And he managed that for several years.
Yeah. Yes, and then he eventually moved to Seattle, and where he retired from the mining business.
He was an old friend of mine.
I would have liked to have met him. I found his reports and his work, his craftsmanship, his engineering talent to really be top quality. I read his master's thesis, his engineering thesis, and it was really quite well done in the 1920s. And he just simply showed, I mean, he was a really sophisticated engineer. I would have really have liked to met that man. But you know, you get a lot of, here was they hired these engineers, the cream de la cream of the mining engineering schools. And this would be a great place to cut your teeth. And you know, this is a company on the move. And so quite a few of them start here, and a few of them moved on up into the New York-based office. If you got broke in here, you could really parlay this into something really good in mining engineering. And what's more, the company expected you to publish or perish. The mine superintendent himself, who grew up in the School of Hard Knocks and had a bachelor's in mining engineering, in the 1940s, he himself set the pace by going to Milner Roberts School of Engineering going over on the weekends and that, or once a month, and himself picked up a master's degree in mining engineering from Milner Roberts in the late 40s. Now, he didn't need it. He was in his late 40s, early 50s. He was, you know, he was the mining superintendent. He had everything he wanted. He lived in Shally 1. But the company financed the journeys of its mining engineering staff to all the major conferences, and urged them to publish their findings, to read and publish their findings at mining Congress conferences. And they took great pride in the accomplishments of their mining engineering staff. And that's a very important important thing to get home, that they were hiring people who were not only trying to keep up with the state of their art, but to contribute to the state of their art, and to, you know, constantly expand the knowledge of how to mine. That sounds kind of dull to many of you people, I guess, but this was a research and development place. It could be viewed as that. You know, it was a growth situation for some people. Yeah.
Did Holden serve as a model for other mining communities around the world or in this country?
No, I don't really think so, because you see, it was just simply too isolated. No cars, no constant traffic in and out. Some of the ideas about work and about what should be done in industry were, you know, carried out of here by men and women who had worked here. The secretary-treasurer of the Washington State Labor Council, who's presently running for president, came out of high school and worked here, and then went on to be a leader in the communication workers, and is now secretary-treasurer, been there for about 18 years. He speaks about this place where he cut his first working teeth out of high school. He really speaks favorably about this labor management relationship that existed here in terms of what should be done. The mining company and the union, you know, test each other out. It's a great document showing the testimony. They kept notes on their negotiation, and it was really good. They were testing them to see how committed they were to their craft and their skill and all. The union itself, in this remote area, always sent two delegates to national conventions. You know, you'd say, well, why should they bother? You know, you can get so absorbed and love your area so much, why leave and go to me? But they were all committed. You know, they had a special pride. I don't know if I answered your question completely. No, I just don't think it was simply too good to be true. Now, some people think that I look at this situation as a utopia. That I don't really pay much attention to class consciousness. Well, I want you to know that a lot of people here were very patriotic, and that they even sent back to their CIO union, which was eventually found to be communist-led and thrown out of the CIO, that they used to send notes back to Denver and say, bomb the communists out of the party, and don't come up here, leave us alone, you don't help us. And it's really, you know, peculiar that way, you know? Okay, question?
There's no sanitary up here, is there?
No.
What'd they do with them?
Well, I just took them out and took them to the Chelan morgue and fixed them up and buried them.
I find that kind of unusual.
Well, where are you going
to be here?
They don't have the land leased. Was that possible? Mm-hmm. That possible? You know, it's not in the lease.
I see.
I mean, there's a cemetery in Chelan, buried in there. Mm-hmm. They if they die. Mm-hmm. Yes.
How long was the lease for when they built it in 37, and how long do they plan to be here?
They only planned to run it for 10 years. They only thought that they would run 1,000 ton of rock through a day, and they found out within 2 months of production they could do 2,000 ton of rock a day. And they were absolutely delighted because they had this white Russian here who is a metallurgist, and he was able to raise the recovery rate from 94% to 97%. And in the mining industry, E.B. Schley of Howe Sound had been known throughout the American and British mining world as the engineer, the metallurgist, who had raised the recovery rate to 94%. And Schley, who was the president, flew up here in a rage. He just couldn't believe that they could get that high recovery rate. And the story goes that Zenodorov and Schley used to run up and down the flotation cells, dipping and running to the assay office, you know, and this Russian, you know, talking in, with this Russian brogue to his English, and Schley were arguing and yelling, and Schley was calling him a liar, and what they were doing was challenging each other, and they were proud of the fact what they were doing. And they argued back and forth, you know, and so Zandon managed to get it to 97%, which was really good. When I stood my general exams for my doctorate, my final defense, I had the largest committee in the graduate faculty that the school of history had ever seen, because the School of Mining Engineering and other people who had known about this had came over to hear this defense. And one of the fellows that took exception to the state of mining knowledge that existed about the kind of ore they were processing here, and he said that really they had not known the specific, based upon knowledge in the 1970s, a more specific name for the kind of copper. And if they had known that it wasn't, that they had missed by a slight degree the kind of copper they were working on, they could have probably got a higher recovery rate. And that counts for the 3% that they didn't get out. Well, anyway, you know, it's always after the fact. It says, well, that's really nice to know after the fact. It says, nothing to do about it now, Dr. So-and-so. And he says, because he wanted me, he said, did they really know what they were doing, the mining engineers? And I said, of course, based upon the time and where they were, they had the best information possible going for them. And they really did, I think, you know. And anyway, question?
Did they look for extensions of the
Yeah.
across the valleys?
They got a special grant of over $1 million in 1954, just before they took off the National Defense Stockpiling Program, to go into the Buckskin Formation, to tunnel out to see if there was another zone over there. And they used part of that money to run surveys and to check once again along the Holden Lake Trail to see if the vein went out that way, if it was worth it. They missed the buckskin ore body out here. If there was one, they didn't find it, so they shut down that operation in the Buckskin Formation. And then it was just a matter of mining down and finishing what they could. For the most part, the mine had bottomed out. And everybody finds an excuse for shutting it up. Now, the company was in a management struggle over philosophy. Well, this company was shifting its gears from mining to manufacturing. And they were struggling. There was a leadership transition going on. They were trying to close down their mines at Snow Lakes, Manitoba, and Britannia Beach and Chelan as fast as they could so they could switch into manufacturing and get out of this business because it wasn't as profitable as it had once been. And so you use the excuse of labor costs too much. You use the excuse the equipment's depleted and it was. You find, you know, all kinds of justifications for it.
With newer technology, is there any...
No, the mine's bottomed out. And the fact of that is that on the side, they brought in L.T. Postel from Cominco, which was once Granby, and other people to walk this mine once more. So third-party references to confirm that, in effect, the mine was all done. It was exhausted. It was bottomed out. And that's it. You know? And now you can say, well, okay. Well, do you want to open it up as a mine? You know, do you think everybody would show up at evening vespers? Do you think you'd be able to find volunteer help to work out in the dining hall? You know, and probably have to establish a wage structure and a whole bit, wouldn't you?
No, I was wondering, with new technology, is there any, could they go in and find anything else?
Well, you know, Britannia Beach is now on a place in Canada, 20 miles out of North Vancouver, along the coast there. It's now open for tours, and they were using Uke trucks. They were using trucks inside the mine until they closed a few years ago. And they do have, these new kinds of things to do, you know, this kind of mining, these big bore drills and things like that. I really don't think so. I mean, I shouldn't be so categorical like that, but I really don't. I think they had to have a Butte, Montana, or Bingham Canyon, and you know. And plus, you know, you've got to have the right atmosphere. You know, you've got to have a emergency wartime crisis situation where you can bypass all of these so-called, you know, concerns of local commissions and environmentalists and all that in order to get this done. You know, you have to do that. And I think it's fair to say that there are other places in the Cascades where if they need it, I think the nation will go after it. But you have to, you know, you'll have to find some way to avoid the high cost of battling with those protectionists. And those people who have become, you know, the self-righteous protectors of, the wilderness and the world. I don't know. Yes.
In hiring the people that actually went into the mines, did they require certain physical and mental checks or...
Physical.
No mental tests or anything like that were required of these people too?
No. The mental test would come at the office in Chelan. I'd look you over, you know.
Breathing was going
to... Well, I mean, you had to fill out an extensive resume. You know, you just didn't go and say, like we do now, if you want to work in a, you know, for a franchise operation. I mean, you had to sit down in your background like you fill out for a professional job. And then they interviewed you extensively, and they wanted to meet your family in case you were thinking about coming up here. And it's really interesting to read some of these resumes. Yeah. So, you know, you'd get, they had a good two, a man and a woman, a very competent team that did a lot of that screening.
But there was no distinct physical characteristic that they were after for people to go in the mine.
Well, they were hiring whites. And they were hiring males. And they were not hiring prostitutes. And they were hiring miners. People that wanted to work and would work and knew something about the mining business. They also would hire, towards the end, Chicanos. Because their mines in the Southwest, they learned that the Mexican Americans were good workers. Not many came, but they were open to that group.
They preferred experienced miners?
Yes. They took some high school graduates locally. And they hired a lot of college kids in the summertime. Kids who would want to get a job with them under the disguise, I'm going into mining engineering and I'd like this experience. So what the guys used to do to test them was on the 3-minute fuses for the dynamite, they would cut them in half, tell them to go up and light the fuse up in a stove, and then they'd say, run, you've got to run like crazy to get out of the way. And they only had a minute and a half to get out of the way instead of 3 minutes. And sometimes these kids would run out of the way and hide, and you know, they'd just barely get there. And sometimes there would be kids that would just keep running. You know, but there were lots of, my father had about 2 or 3 college students that stayed at our house, and they kind of filled in a gap for him since I was born when he was 35, and you know, they filled in a gap. He wanted, you know, some of these became law professors or dentists in Bellevue, or you know, they had their own manufacturing establishments now, and they, you know, plenty of opportunity to work. You could work 2 or 3 jobs if you wanted. You could work 24 hours a day if you wanted to. All kinds of things. And you know, in a year you can make enough money to go to school. For 4 years. if you really wanted to. There are a lot of people that, you know, did well, are doing well. Question? No questions?
What happened to Hollis Island? Are they still in existence?
No, they're not. They gave up the ghost as a company. And the Britannia Beach mine in Hollis Island just closed here a couple years ago. I'm going to show slides tonight, especially of the building of the mine and of the what it was like during the production years, because there's a couple of people up here, that the Plimptons, and Mrs. Plimpton is going to leave later this week, and she won't be able to see the other one. And I simply am going to be pressed by time tonight at 7 o'clock to make sure I get all the slides in, just showing the whole sequence of what it was like building the mine in 1937-38, what it was like to mine, to mill, what it was like life was like in the 1500 level, what life was like down here, what life was like in the miners' village, what people did. And that will take, I'll be really busy flipping those slides fast, and I'm not going to, it's before Vespers, so I'll mainly concentrate tonight on talking about the mining years themselves.
Were these obviously were pretty good pictures they were taken as the construction and everything went on?
Yes.
Were they actually slides, or were they photographs and you made slides of them?
They were photographs, I made slides of them, yeah. People would lend them.
They kept a good photographic document of the whole construction process? And
well, yeah, there were a couple. The mine had, on occasion, had papers, some commercial photography, but just most of the time, you know, people were pretty proud of what they did. When you run into somebody who was in charge of putting all the piping in the mill and that was a big deal, you know, and he'd take a lot of pictures of it. That's my mill, you know. You know, guys took pictures, you'll see pictures of the trucks, you know, the big ore trucks, 4 of them abreast here in downtown. That'd be pretty kind of, you know, those are our trucks. You know, hey, and, you know, it's kind of, this is our accomplishment. You know, this is our town. And then, you know, it's pictures of each other and that town.
How did you say the ballpark area was used before?
As a staging area. Because see, the road went, there was a bridge that went from by the corral, you see, you know where the people fish off that rock? The bridge, there was a bridge that went around there and then up to the mine that way.
Oh.
And then they built this big car bridge here.
Oh, I see.
Once they got the equipment going up that way. And then there was a bridge even beyond that for a while. A bridge above the picnic grounds that went up to the fan. There was a fan system for ventilating the mine so that so they could keep the air fairly clear so that the miners didn't come down with silicosis, which is a real concern. Maybe it isn't to you.
How did the power come in?
Up the far side of the lake. That was a big controversy. The hearings that went on, the old pioneers insisted that the power lines be built along the section of the lake and places where it would not disturb the scenery that they had grown up with on Lake Chelan. And they, in their testimony, in the recorded testimony, they constantly talk about, don't put it up this side of the lake because it'll destroy this beauty in this area, and it'll look ugly seeing power lines going up that side, 1937. Okay, so they built it up the manse. They built it up the manse inside, okay? And then in certain areas, they had to put pipes and cliffs to hang the 3 wires. And then when they got to about Prince Creek, where you can see over to Donkey Falls, then they spanned the lake there from Bear Creek across, just below Prince Creek, across Lake Chelan, and then up over Donkey Lake, then across Donkey Lake, and then they spanned the Railroad Creek Canyon over to the Switchback Road, and then they followed parallel the road up here, and then came out across the tailings and up there. 55 miles of right-of-way, and they got it all in a year, less than a year.
Is this Washington Water Power?
Yes, it's the old Ready Kilowatt, WWP. Yeah. That's how I called home. On Sundays, I would go down to the Washington Water Power building down on the Monroe, by the Monroe Street Bridge in Spokane, and I would ring long and short on the Washington Water Power phone and call and talk to my folks at home, and I, you know, talk to Dad and say, yeah, don't bother me, I won't listen to the ball game. I'm not going to give you $5. Let me talk to Mom. It's a big deal. Walk down from Boone Street down to the university where I was staying as a boarding student, walk down through Skid Row, and you know, go over and talk and then come back. That's kind of fun. Any other questions?